I don't know what the questions are. I haven't seen them. I don't see that data. I haven't looked at this at all. I'm working on a different grant right now. So,
okay.
So this will be interesting. You're getting a pure experience here.
Okay. Well, I think this is like my sixth or seventh one. So, you know, sometimes if I go through all the questions, the interview just goes on and on and on. So I'll probably skip over a lot. Okay. So, you know who I'm an assistant professor at Indiana University of Bloomington, and I met you on a quarantine conversation on Facebook, and we started talking about my new project a little bit. So thank you for being willing to come out of your day off to chat with me. Can you sort of introduce yourself, and also if you could say the date and time, that would be great.
I will have to open up my trusty Mac to find out what time it is and the day is. I don't even know what day it is. Today, I'm Kelly Kerr Cook.
Okay.
Today's date is Wednesday, May 20th, and it is currently 1:10 p.m. Eastern Time.
And you're in Indianapolis, right? Indiana.
Yeah,
okay.
I am.
So you gave your name. What are the primary things you do on a day-to-day basis, as in work or extracurricular activities? What do you normally do day-to-day? Pre-pandemic.
Okay. So as you know, I work for the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute as an office manager. I am also a advocate for women's health justice, and I'm a writer and a film producer. So my child is, I have an only child as well as two stepchildren, but they are all out of the nest now. So mainly I'm just a dog mom and just a regular citizen.
Okay. You said you live in Indianapolis. What is it like where you live? And you can address that in any way you like, in terms of the city or the neighborhood or however you want to address it.
Sure. So I live just northeast of the city, just over the county line, in a little small town in Indiana called Fortville, Indiana. I think there are under 4,000 people here, I think. I don't interact much in the community. I just kind of go to work in the city and come home. Most of my socializing and my family are in Chicago, and my work as a film producer is also in Chicago. So I don't spend a lot of time in my community. From what I can see during this pandemic, and from what I've heard, we have scored like a D- or an F for compliance with social distancing, quarantining. So
when you say we, do you mean Fortville or do you mean Indianapolis? Do you mean Indiana or Chicago?
Chicago is completely locked down still. And so I'm hearing stories from my friends. I haven't been home in 6 months. I haven't been home since Christmas. And from what I understand, I haven't seen any of my friends, of course. I talk to them on FaceTime or Zoom or, you know, just checking in with folks. But for the most part, people are compliant there. If you look into just regular newspapers or anything related to Chicago, you'll see tons of videos of people showing the empty city and all of the landmarks and tourist traps being completely empty. So from what I understand, folks in Chicago are complying.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Indianapolis, Marion County comprises the entire city, and they have the worst of the COVID-19. And then my home county of Lake County, Indiana, is the second worst. And then the third worst is Hamilton County, which is just north of the city. That would be Carmel, Fishers, Noblesville, some of those places. We are just adjacent to the east of Indianapolis in Hancock County. And Hancock County, not complying. It doesn't seem to have the level of disease and, you know, COVID counts that the other counties do. But, you know, the whole time, kids have been playing in the neighborhood. I can hear them outside playing. I see neighbors walking around, no masks. On the very few times that I've had to go to the store or whatever, no masks, no social distancing. So we have just decided, especially after what we went through as a family, early on, we just stay home. We're just quarantined in the house, you know. So
right. Well, thank you for explaining that. That's really helpful, especially because I'm not back there. Do you remember when you first heard about COVID-19? Do you remember what your initial thoughts were about COVID-19 and also then how your thoughts have changed since then? And I know that's, for you, a big question.
Yeah, yeah. So, like everybody else, I heard about this, you know, shortly after Christmas into January when it was spreading in China. I was concerned, but not terribly concerned. What happened to me was, so my last day at the Institute in the office, normal life, was probably March 3rd or 4th. I was going to leave for the weekend to go celebrate my mom's 70th birthday in Florida, which I did. I was a little bit nervous about it, but at that time, you know, it just wasn't an issue. We just didn't think about it like that 2 months ago, 3 months ago. While I was there, I started noticing that it was being covered on the news and there were two cases in Fort Myers. And my mom asked me if I would just stay there. And I said, no, I don't want to do that because I can't be stuck here. I don't have my laptop. I'm going to go ahead and go home. And that was March 9th. Left out of the Fort Myers airport and noticed that during spring break, it was kind of sparse on the flight, but, you know, there were empty seats, and that's very strange. By the time I got to Atlanta, flights were being canceled. So this was Monday, March 9th. Flights were being canceled. The plane from Atlanta to Indianapolis was only half full, which was very, very strange. Got to Indianapolis. The airport was not crowded at all, just in the middle of the afternoon. It was eerie. So I went ahead and went home and started worrying. And I never went back to the Institute. I was supposed to go back on Tuesday, March 10th, but it just so happened I was sick. I had a cold or had picked something up along the way. And I didn't want to go to work. We've always had a very strict don't come here if you're sick policy. So I ended up going to the doctor on Thursday. No, it would have been Wednesday. And they gave me, I thought maybe I had the flu. Who knows if I had this virus? I had all these symptoms and they said they were going to test me for strep, the flu, and mono. And it all came back negative. And the doctor came back and he didn't have a mask on. And everybody had a mask on, the whole deal, the PPE, you know, just very different from the way they normally do things at my doctor's office. And he didn't have a mask on. He's like, oh, you have some kind of virus or something. I'm going to give you antibiotics, which I thought was very strange. Just in case it gets bad over the weekend, you can have them and take them, which I never did. And I said, well, do you think this is the virus? He told me, it could be, but we don't know. There's not a reliable test. And I just was like, oh my God, he's lying to me.
Is that what you said? He's lying?
Yeah, because you know there was a test for it. They just didn't want to waste it on some random broad, you know, some random housewife in, you know, guy's housewife. So I left there and I was really, really nervous and scared. Turned out whatever it was I had ran its course. Nobody else in my household got sick. It was fine. So that's basically what life was like leading up to the pandemic. My son was still at school at Ball State, didn't want to come home. He had his 21st birthday that week. You know, he was not interested in coming home at all. By the following Monday, Jason had closed the Institute and said, you know, they're probably going to start closing campus. He's like, we're just not going to take the risk. So, there was a question, you know, how it went through the university, like, can everybody work from home? whose work needs a secure line? Do you need to secure into the VPN? Do you need to do this, that, and everything else?
Right.
So it was just like utter chaos trying to get things together. And then that's when things got really weird here at my home.
So if I can just pause you for a second. So you were really careful with your timeline. It sounds like your last day physically at work, face-to-face, you didn't know it was going to be your last day. It sounds like you got sick, and because you already have a don't-come-to-work policy,
you
never went back to work, but you didn't know that the last day you were at work.
Right.
Many people are in this situation where they didn't know that was the last time they were going out. They didn't know that was the last time they were saying goodbye to their coworkers. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it was very strange. We have a postdoc, Jason Price, who actually is from Berkeley. And, you know, I had seen him before I left for Florida and never saw him again. And I won't see him again.
Because this was the end of his year.
Yeah, his contract's up this summer. And he had gone back to his wife and child who live in Berkeley and was immediately told to shelter in place.
Right.
Because they were about a week ahead of us. And
right.
Are you in California now?
I am.
Lucky. So, yeah. So so I don't think I'm ever going to see him in person again, which is unfortunate. He's my friend. He has a home here in Broad Ripple that he sold. And they're just going to pack it up and have their goods sent to them. Sell their car, whatever. So that's weird.
Yeah.
Graduate students that graduated that, you know, if we ever get to go back to our office, which of course we will, I won't be working with them anymore. So I didn't know when I left for that trip, I didn't know that that was going to be the last time that I was going to see some of my colleagues.
Right.
Table guy here. Excuse me for one second.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Where's it going?
I did not find a splinter in the attic at all.
Okay.
So I don't think there is a splinter.
Okay.
Yes.
It does. Yeah. So feel free to take apart anything you need to. I'm in the interview that I mentioned.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Okay. Sorry, Liza.
No problem. And if I could also just pause on that moment that you were at your doctor's office, which was your primary care physician's office, it sounded like. Okay.
Yeah. I was seeing another doctor in the practice. It wasn't my normal doctor, but yeah. It's where I've gone.
You do work on women's health care, so you have an interest, an intellectual interest in that. And it sounds like you view that moment through a sort of women's health care lens. Do you want to say more about that moment and how you think he was seeing you and why he didn't give you in particular a test?
Yeah, I'm sure it happens to women all the time, and I'm sure it was happening to a lot of people who are this guy's patients. Like I mentioned, this is not my normal physician, who is a woman, and I've seen her for 20 years, so she knows me. Perhaps if I had seen her, she might have been willing to give a test. But we found out later that tests were kind of scant, and I don't have the kind of underlying conditions that would necessitate a test. Who knows? But for him to say to me, we don't have a reliable test for COVID-19, and this was probably March 11th, you know, I guess that's the first time that I've ever felt like a doctor was not taking me seriously or not tending to my needs or not telling me the truth. It was very patronizing. I will certainly never see that individual again. And I thought it was kind of reckless too. Maybe it's true they don't have a test. Maybe they don't have a physical test available to them right then and there. But there were reliable tests for COVID-19. So to say to me that there's no reliable test, I just thought that was very strange. And it kind of made me panic a little bit.
And did you feel like he was concerned about you? Did you feel like he wanted to know if you got worse? Did you feel like you would get help if you got worse?
Not at all. Not at all. If I had gotten worse, I probably would have called my regular physician that's in that practice. But I think she probably would have cared, but I don't think he cared at all. It was weird.
Okay. So we were answering the question of when you first heard about it, your initial thoughts, and then how your thoughts changed since then. And kind of tied to that is, what's concerned you most? What issues have been the most concerning during the pandemic? And of course, there's probably many, and they're probably interconnected.
Yeah, I've tried to stay really robotic about it. I have OCD that's contamination based, which is I'm controlled by medication, but it's really easy for me to get carried away. So I've just tried to be very factual, only looking at the science, being very mindful of, you know, what emotions might be behind my thinking. So my main concern is that I would catch it and give it to somebody who can't survive it, or catch it, be asymptomatic, and then be spreading it. So that's kind of where I come from. I'm not terribly concerned about getting it myself for some reason, but I'm terribly very concerned about possibly infecting one of my friends who's diabetic. I have a friend who's HIV positive. I can't go anywhere near him because what if I have it? So that's why I haven't been seeing my friends at all, because I'm worried about them.
Okay, so that issue then daily behavior, which is to self-isolate as much as possible, it sounds like.
Yeah, and in the beginning, my husband took 3 weeks off from his job, and some of that ended up being bereavement time, but I've never felt like I have a proper quarantine, because eventually my son came home from Ball State when they closed their campus, so that kind of broke my 2 weeks, and then when my husband started going back to work, you know, every day, he's very careful, but you know, every day that breaks our social isolation. So I feel like the least I can do is just stay home. If I go out and walk the dog, or I go to the store, you know, it's gloves, a mask. And I know some of that might be a little extra, but I'm terrified that somehow I'll get it and give it to someone else, and then they will go through what my family went through.
Yeah. And do you feel ready to talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Okay. Do you think part of your being so careful comes from the losses that you've experienced?
Absolutely. And my husband made me a timeline of what happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you pull that up again?
Sure.
It's so detailed.
Oh yeah, he's retired from the military. He's very, you know, totally opposite from me, but organized. Yeah.
Do you want to follow that timeline? Do you have, you got it right there. Do you want to sort of go along that? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So are you ready for me to start that portion?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So my husband is Carrie. These are the cast of characters here. So, my husband is Carrie Cook.
Okay.
His brother, he had, three brothers. Brandon is the youngest. Carrie is the oldest. Brandon is the one who died. Mm-hmm. And then Beverly is their mom. And I am my husband's second wife. We've been married for almost 8 years now. His entire family does not live in Indiana. We are both from the same hometown. We've reconnected later in adulthood, but his entire nuclear family had moved to Kentucky. And his daughters live in Arkansas with their mother, which was his last base that he was stationed at. And they decided they all wanted to stay there, and he decided he wanted to come here. So that's how that happened after he retired.
Okay.
So looking at Carrie's timeline, the first thing, it's really interesting because this is not the way this unfolded in life, but his timeline is chronological. So on 11 March 2020, he says that Governor Beshear asked Kentucky churches to cancel their services amid coronavirus outbreaks. And I don't, maybe it's more help, what's the most helpful way to go by his timeline or to tell you, like, in my own words, what happened?
I think whatever feels best to you. I want to acknowledge that you prepared. So whatever feels right to you, if you want to just refer to that as necessary or maybe look at it, however you want to do it is totally
okay. Okay, let's do it that way. I'll tell you how this, I'll give you a synopsis and then I'll tell you in detail what happened. So basically what ended up happening was, so my mother-in-law was a devout Pentecostal, and she lived in a very small community in the middle of nowhere in Kentucky. It would have been one would think that this would be a place that is so isolated that they wouldn't have the virus. Okay. So as I mentioned before, I had come home on March 9th, and then on March 11th, Governor Beshear of Kentucky said, churches don't be meeting, don't be congregating, don't do that. Not a lawful order, but that's what he said. And he is from that area. He's actually from Dawson Springs, Kentucky, I believe. And that's where she lived. So, okay. So I would say probably on March 11th, he did that. And I had been home for about a week or two. We got a call on March 24th, after we'd been home for a while, from my mother-in-law, Beverly, and she said that Brandon had been admitted to the hospital, diagnosed with COVID-19.
Mm.
Brandon had been living with her for about 6 months, and I think he was 37. And to the best of my knowledge, what happened was he had been sick for a couple weeks and was getting really bad and had some kind of diabetic event. And my mother-in-law had diabetes and the other brother has it. Nobody knew that Brandon had it. So he was basically in ketoacidosis. So by the time they had taken him and gotten him admitted to the hospital, he was already unconscious. So they put him in ICU right away. And Beverly said that the health department came by and wanted to know where they had been, who they had been in contact with, you know, what the situation was, asked her to quarantine. The other brother lives on the property. One of the other brothers lives on the property, but not in the house. They were asked to quarantine. And my husband asked her, where have you been? Oh, nowhere. I haven't been anywhere. Okay. All right. You didn't go to church. Oh, no. Well, that was not the truth. So after this is now March 24th, 2 days later on March 26th, according to my husband's timeline, Beverly was also admitted to the hospital. And they were saying that she had COVID-19 or suspected COVID-19, but we could still talk to her. She was talking on the phone. She was communicating with us, and we were finding out from one of the younger brothers that what was going on in the hospital. So she and Brandon were both in the same hospital. Brandon was in the ICU, totally unconscious, hooked up to a ventilator immediately. But we were like, oh, okay, well, you know, he's 37. He'll be all right, you know. And I think that we were in denial that this was happening. And at the time, we didn't know. I mean, we knew what COVID-19 was, but we didn't know how virulent it was. You know, we didn't know. We're like everybody else. We don't know. I'm not an epidemiologist. We didn't know. What we later found out was that on March 15th and 16th, my mother-in-law's church, her Pentecostal church, which is called the Star of Bethlehem, in Dawson Springs, Kentucky, had a church revival with another church in the area, bringing in guests and a guest revivalist from Texas. So this is 4 days after the governor mentioned we shouldn't be congregating. Now, I have seen, if you look in the news, if you look this up, if you look up Hopkins County, Kentucky, you'll see, I mean, the governor has chastised them. This is not a secret. But that's what they did. They had a revival. I'm not quite clear on whether this revival happens every year at this time, or if the revival was done in, I guess, reaction to this. I don't know a lot about that. I'm not Pentecostal. I'm not even Christian. So I only know kind of ancillary information and anecdotal things about the way this goes in this church. So they were supposed to have a 3-day revival, but I know this is, Liza, this gets so crazy. You're not even going to believe this. It's metaphorical snake handling is what it is.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Keep going.
Okay. So these people, who knows how many, several hundred, I would assume, kept meeting 15th, 16th. Well, on the 17th, on St. Patrick's Day, Governor Beshear was like, no bars are to be open, no restaurant, no more. This is lawful order. Nobody's going anywhere. So they canceled their third day of the revival. And this pastor, he leaves and takes off and goes to, I believe, Louisiana is what I saw in some news appointments or news items. So off he went. So he was like, he probably brought this into the community. Because by the time this happened, by the time Brandon was admitted to the hospital, another guy had already died. And actually two people. And they were saying that he worked at GE Aviation, which I think is maybe like a government contractor, like a factory or whatever. And he was an old guy, you know, he was like near retirement, and turns out he was a member of the church. So contact tracing has figured this out. The news has figured this out. Okay, so we found out from one of the brothers that yes, they had been at the revival, both of them. And that's very dangerous for my mother-in-law because she has diabetes and she's elderly. You know, she was elderly. She was only 69. I don't know if we consider that elderly anymore, but, you know, she's older. She has underlying health conditions, not in the greatest health. But Brandon, we didn't expect that from him because, you know, he was only 37. So they're in the hospital and people start dying. So on March 26th, Beverly was admitted to the hospital. And then on March 30th, Brandon actually died in the ICU. And they would not allow her, even though they had both had COVID-19, they wouldn't allow her into the ICU to be with him. I don't know why. I don't know if they didn't have the space for that. I don't know if they didn't know enough about, you know, who knows why. She, on March the 30th, she was able to tell us, she was able to call us and tell us that Brandon had died. And we knew that his organs were shutting down overnight. We knew that it did not look good. She was able to spend a moment and call us, and she was obviously very distraught. And we both spoke to her for a moment. And then she said that they were going to sedate her and that she would talk to us when she woke up. And that never happened. The next day.
Oh, Kelly, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really hard. It was really obviously very hard on my husband.
Yeah.
And very, very hard on his children. They were very close with their grandmother. And she was a very sweet lady, very nice woman, and he didn't deserve this. You know, nobody deserves it, but it was really sad.
And
so,
confusing, it sounds like, too. Very confusing.
Very confusing. Just, I don't know how much knowledge she had about what was going on in the community.
Right.
I know that her son, Brandon, the youngest, he was the third person to die from COVID in their county. Mm-hmm. And obviously everybody was infected at, you know, the same place. So at this point, we knew that they had been at this revival. And we were really upset about it. So when Brandon died, we were talking to my husband's brother, Mike, who was kind of, there's another brother, just family dynamics. There's another brother, the second oldest, my husband doesn't speak with. So the third brother, Mike, is kind of the liaison for the entire family. Everybody loves Mikey. So, you know, he's kind of giving out the information. And he did tell us that they had been at the revival. But I mentioned to him in a message that I was like, does anybody know who is responsible for scheduling this after the governor said no? And he very politely, but very strongly shut me down because it turns out that he works for the guy. Right? So sorry, my allergies are so bad today.
Actually same, so you're fine.
Yeah, hideous. So this is a very small community and people have very close-knit relations. I know that this particular brother was not at the revival per se, but he knows the people in this community. And his partner later in the day made a very vague statement on her own personal Facebook page about nobody better be pointing the finger at this church. They've lost people and they should be compassionate. And I think that was a very, she knew I was going to see that. My husband and I are the only people who don't share the faith. So, okay. I was like, I'm just going to mind my own business here. I had no idea how this was going to turn out at the time. So my mother-in-law, my brother-in-law has died. It is now March 30th. He has died. And the 31st, my mother-in-law was put on a ventilator and they moved her up to ICU. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't move her to say goodbye to her son, but you know, once she was on the ventilator, they moved her up there. So for, 9 days, we thought she was going to get better. They said that they had put her on the ventilator kind of prophylactically. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how much she was struggling breathing, but I know that her oxygen was dropping. But they only had this ventilator. At one point, they were able to turn it down to like 50%, then 40%. And we had every indication that she was going to recover. Everything looked good. Everything looked good until it didn't. So on the morning of April 8th, I got up and my husband was home and, he said, hey, I got a message from my brother and, I don't think my mom's going to make it. And I was just gobsmacked. I was like, what? Like yesterday, it was improving. They had turned the settings down. She was doing so much better. He's like, overnight, she just crashed. And this is about 10 o'clock in the morning. And about 30 minutes later, my brother-in-law called and wanted to know if we wanted to say goodbye to her. And I was like, well, she's not conscious. How are we going to do this? Like, I wasn't even putting it together in my head. And he said, well, if you'd like, the nurse can call you on FaceTime and you can see her and you can say goodbye if you want to. Well, of course, we wanted to. We didn't even think about it. So we did that. And we spent about 5 minutes. And I said, well, I know that you have other people to call. So she said, well, we're going to take her off the ventilator when everybody's finished. And I said, she said, do you want me to call you back? And I said, yeah, of course. And by this time, my husband was just devastated. And just the lights were on, but nobody was home. And he just doesn't have, as a person, he doesn't have, he's not good at showing emotion or experiencing emotion. It's, you know, he's a combat veteran. He's already got issues with that. So, I was just like, oh my God, what do I do? You know? So, an hour passed and I thought, well, maybe she didn't make it off the ventilator. And then the nurse called back and she said, okay, we have unconnected, you know, we've disconnected the ventilator and, she's still with us, but you know, if there's anything you'd like to say, or if you would like to sit with her, you can do that. So I'm getting a FaceTime from an unknown number who turns out to be an ICU nurse. And it was like, she kind of showed me her face. And I mean, I've seen doctors in PPE before, but this was like, remember in ET when they set up the tent? That's what it looked like. It was scary. So I sat with her for about 45 minutes while on FaceTime while she died. And it was surreal. So this wasn't the first time that I've sat with a dying person. My first father-in-law, I helped with his hospice. So I knew kind of what to expect. But it was really weird. And this was a hospital setting rather than a home setting. So that was weird. And what was surreal about it was I think the nurse might have been trying to help by turning up this really loud contemporary Christian music. And my husband wouldn't look at the camera. He was sitting right there, but he didn't want to look right then, you know, for 45 minutes. He just sat there and he was like, I was like, do you want me to ask them to turn that music down? Because it was on Spotify and it kept breaking in with Spotify commercials, which just, I felt like I was like leaving my body. I just couldn't stand the racket of this music, this awful music. And then the Spotify commercials, and then you've got the hospital noises and, you know, all the noises that come along with that. So she, my husband said, I know why they're doing that. And I was like, ugh, I'd rather not. But I didn't say anything. I think that, you know, maybe it was her wish. You know, maybe she told, who knows? I don't know what they were doing. It was really weird. So we watched her pass, and the nurse was, the ICU nurse, she just kept the camera turned on my mother-in-law the entire time, and she had a mask on. So I could only, you know, kind of see her eyes, which were closed, and her hair. And she passed really peacefully. In some ways, I think that she probably had been gone for a while, you know. So that's what happened there. And then it was just kind of like the nurse was like, okay, we're going to disconnect everything and do everything. And, you know, I thank the nurse for giving us the time, because she said that's the first time we've done this. No, it was such a weird thing. And I'm sure she's done it dozens of times since then. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what to do. She's obviously, I'm sure she was very familiar with the death process and stuff like that. But I'm sure she, you know, she's not a producer. She doesn't know how to put the camera angles and, you know, get the sound right. And so it was surreal. It was very strange. So we ended up talking with the funeral director in the town, and she knew my mother-in-law. She didn't know my brother-in-law, but she knew my mother-in-law really well. And it was bizarre because it took like 2 weeks to get them buried. We ended up having a double service, but there was no service really. Some kid who had never preached a funeral before, said some words, and the only way they could do it was over Facebook Live, because at that time, only 10 people could be gathered for anything. So pallbearers, clergy, a couple people from the funeral home, and then that was it. So we couldn't attend the funeral because the family's so large that the people who live right there, that comprised 10 people. We didn't want my husband's daughters to travel.
Mm.
And at this point, the whole county was just lit up with COVID-19. It was not a safe place to travel to. So we made the decision that we weren't going to attend that, and begged the girls not to go either. And one of them is a nursing student who works in a nursing home, and she understood. She understood. So I think for the family, it's not really final yet, you know, because they haven't, you know, my husband and his girls haven't had a chance to visit her gravesite. And they are also not members of that faith, but I think that they would want to do their own thing, you know. So in some ways, yes, they're gone, but it's not real. And the funeral home did not have a lot of experience in doing double funerals, or, you know, I mean, sure, it happens sometimes, but we had to wait for like 2 weeks because the bodies had to be, they weren't equipped with everything and the protocols and the equipment to embalm bodies that are contaminated. So they had to go to a special morgue in, I think, Louisville, which is 2 hours away from there. And they had to be processed differently because at this point they're not sure if, you know, bodies are contaminated or not after, you know, the people who lived in them die from COVID. They don't know. So had to wait a long time for the funeral, and then it was just like really bizarre. And it's just like really, again, very surreal to watch something like that for a family member. It was just really weird. It was really weird. And not good coverage at all. They were far away. The wind was whipping through there. There were no, there were some flowers. We sent a bunch of flowers down there. But we couldn't, they had the casket closed for my brother-in-law, but they had it open at the gravesite, which I've never seen that done before. But what else are they going to do? But we couldn't see. They didn't get near, very poor production quality. You know, that's kind of what I'm focusing on to kind of cope with it. Mm. We couldn't really hear what he was saying. Doesn't matter to us. It was weird. It was really weird. And then the funeral feed, it just cut off. And that was what struck me. Like, somebody decided that's the end of the funeral, or I'm finished being here, or my battery is dying on my phone that I'm taping this on. And so it was like, we sat there for about 10 minutes and then it was over. It was like when somebody clicks the meeting on Zoom, end meeting, and then you're done. Very strange to have a funeral situation like that. So that's what happened. We found out as we did our research after my brother-in-law died, between his death and my mother-in-law's death, these churches have scrubbed their Facebooks. So there's no mention of the revival. One of the news outlets down there has a copy of, has a screenshot of the ad for it. That church lawyered up within 2 days. Their pastor did not preach my mother-in-law's funeral, their funerals. He had somebody else doing it, which I thought was strange. One of them completely took their social media down. So the news is aware of it. The governor's aware of it. He has chastised them. My husband has had words with this pastor. You know, it's very strange, Liza. It was really strange.
How did that conversation go?
You know, he was polite to him during the first, they've had two conversations, and that's a whole separate issue. Apparently, he was allegedly named as the executor of my mother-in-law's will. So the conversation about that did not go well. And I didn't hear that conversation because the guy called my husband while he was at work. So, but the first conversation, he was
the transcript reflect my shock, which is on my face.
Right. Let the record show.
Yeah, let the record show that I am shocked.
It's
a shock upon shock.
Yeah, it gets really weird. The whole thing gets really weird, but that first conversation, he spoke with the guy, and the guy kept saying to my husband, I wish we had recorded the conversation, because he kept saying, I feel relieved talking to you, because my husband was very polite to him, and thank you very much for whatever, you know, services you provided. And he was like, yeah, I was really worried about talking to you. And I was like, well, you know, my husband is about 6'3", weighs about 250 pounds. He's a veteran. He's got a very deep, booming voice. He's kind of scary. So I don't know if this guy was, I don't know what he had heard about my husband. But he seemed very nervous to talk to him. I don't know if that's because we're the ones that don't share the faith. I don't know if he knew he was going to be blamed, because we do blame him.
Okay.
Yeah, we do. The rest of the family doesn't seem to, but we absolutely blame him for negligence. We think that they were telling people about the revival on Facebook, and this is what has been scrubbed according to the media reports out of there, but they were telling people, oh, you know, you can still come to church if you're sick. You should definitely come to the revival. They just have the flu, you know. Your family members just, you know, come on down. Come on down.
And do you think that there's a correlation between your rejection of Christianity and your willingness to blame him and the rest of the family's acceptance of Christianity, perhaps, and so their acceptance of the pastor and his explanation of the event?
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. The thought has crossed my mind. The thought has crossed my mind. I don't want to inject my my own judgment about the religious aspects of this, because I know that, you know, I mean, I was never Pentecostal. All my family members are Presbyterians, and you know, that's very different. Very, very different.
But you reject Christianity altogether, right? Is that what you meant earlier?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm just a run-of-the-mill atheist, Buddhist. Yeah. I actually did undergo conversion to Buddhism, but that's more of a practice. I don't really consider it religion. But
so have you seen these reports about, in addition to revivals that were going on, not just in Kentucky, but everywhere?
Yeah.
There were invitations specifically put out by pastors asking people with the flu or, well, any type of symptoms, any type of sickness, to come to church to get healed. They were saying to heal COVID-19. I mean, do you see this as part of a larger phenomenon? Because I do.
I do.
Okay.
I do. I don't know how familiar you are with the Pentecostals in general.
I am.
Yeah. Okay. So, it is my opinion, in my summary judgment, I think that they operate as small cults. It's very cultish. I think I mentioned to you earlier that I see this entire unfolding of the revival and whatever it was all about, I see it as metaphorical snake handling. It's a test of faith. Yeah, I think that they're complicit. I think that in the same way that I think that people that went ahead and went on spring break in Florida are complicit, you know, but definitely, I think that's definitely part of it. And I think that, you know, Dear Leader said that it was okay. And Dear Leader's number two.
And still is.
And I mean, you know, why would you listen to me when you can listen to Donald Trump? Why would you listen to scientists or doctors or anybody when your pastor's telling you that your personal presence in a certain building crammed in with a bunch of people, you know? And I mean, and this is not, you know, Pentecostal worship. It must have just been spraying COVID everywhere, because there's singing, there's dancing, there's shouting, there's, I mean, I can't even imagine. Of course this was going to happen, you know? It's just, I don't know. And then you've got, I don't know what my family members' very deeply held personal views are, but, you know, some of these people are basically members of a death cult who want the end to come. They can get raptured away.
Right, yeah. Because of their belief in the rapture.
Because of their belief in the rapture and this, that, and the other thing. You know, they feel like they are ushering in what is supposed to happen. So it's really hard for me to reconcile all of that, because I think it's really reckless and dangerous.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't want to offend these family members who already think I'm the devil.
And that's fascinating. That's really fascinating. And thank you for being willing to share about this. You know, you talked about that the area you're in is rejecting recommendations for masks and social distancing. Are you seeing that division in your family as well?
I don't know, because, you know, I don't know what they're doing day to day. I know that my own family, you know, my parents, they're both staying inside their homes. My aunt is staying inside her home. You know, I know that they're cooperating in Florida and up in the region, but I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought maybe that the people who don't blame the pastor for your mother-in-law passing maybe also don't want to wear a mask.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. My husband and I have kind of distanced ourselves from the entire family just because of the way it's unfolding with the pastor being the executor of her will, and she didn't leave a will that had been, it was a handwritten will. I just feel like, especially as a second wife, I feel like this is not my business. So I just distance myself, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not checking on them and making sure they have masks like I would be my own parents, you know.
Right. So, I mean, because this, you know, can be viewed by future researchers, you know, we're living in this moment and the mask or not mask has become political.
Yes.
It's now being coded as, if you're out, you know, grocery shopping and you're the one wearing a mask, you're a Democrat. And if you're out grocery shopping and you're not wearing a mask, you're a Republican.
Yep.
And there's all sorts of animosity now in public spaces. I mean, this is obvious to us, but it won't be. And I don't know. I just wanted to be in the record, you know, that that's how this has unfolded. And in this moment, at least for me, even though I'm in a liberal state, I'm in California, and even in Southern California, near a beach, there's definitely open animosity between mask wearers and non-mask wearers. And
I guess because I've shut those people out of my life, the non-mask wearers, I've shut them so, I've tried to encapsulate myself over the last 4 years in such an echo chamber bubble. I know it's a dog whistle. You know, when you see Mike Pence rolling up into the Mayo Clinic with no mask on, you know.
It sends a clear message. It sends a very clear message.
It does. It absolutely does. And, you know, now over the last few days, we've all learned and realized that these people are being tested every day. Well, that doesn't mean you can't wear a mask. You know, they don't care about us. They don't care about anybody but themselves.
Couldn't agree.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the advocacy work that I do is specifically anti-Pence because he's so crazy. You know.
Do you want to talk about that work a little bit and then maybe also how that's changed because of COVID-19? and what you think the future?
Yeah. So I'm going to decline to say in the record who I work with and for.
Oh, okay, good. And I don't know, so I won't accidentally say it.
Okay. I don't know if you've heard of this particular movement. I would say right now, I think the last time I looked, we had over 104,000 members. And I know most of the work is disseminated on Facebook. But it is specifically, it began in the state of Indiana to protest Mike Pence. So, and it's very satirical. It's very tongue in cheek. It's very nasty and mean, very mean girls oriented.
That's favorite word, nasty.
Nasty, a bunch of nasty women. Right? So there are several of us who work on this endeavor, and you know, some of them are out there doing comedy shows every day with their memes and rude remarks. A very close friend of mine works with me, and she's a lawyer, so she'll weigh in on law issues. Oh, excuse me, my cable guy. What are we doing?
Quick question.
The other cable box is in my bedroom, and the dog is. Yeah, you'll see it. You can go in there. My dog is not in there anymore.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
I think I know.
Okay.
Set up amplifier out there.
Sweet. Okay. Yeah. Go to the on the right side is my, if you have to go in there, like that door right there. Yeah. And there are no dogs in there that can get you. Okay. Sorry, Liza.
No, no problem. And also, I've kept you for over an hour. So whenever, you know, we need to wrap up, that's, I totally understand, of course.
Oh, I'm just, well, you know, I'm off from Jason today. So I have all day.
Okay.
I can answer all your questions. So the work that we do, we organize grassroots campaigns to do stuff. My role is usually to actually be the person who has the megaphone or the microphone at the state house, and I'll get up and I'll speak on behalf, usually on behalf of Planned Parenthood, but really any organization for choice, I'll speak for them. And just talking about health justice. So I'm more of like the loud mouth. They're the comedians. And, you know, my one friend is he's an attorney, so she advises us on stuff like that. But I'm more serious. I used to be a journalist, so, you know, it's like I might contribute a piece on something legislative or whatever. I'm the more serious one of the bunch, but I'm the meanest one.
Nasty.
Nasty woman with nasty questions. That's how I got interested in your work, though, because I'm very interested in how COVID-19 is affecting Indigenous populations, especially women, especially Indigenous women. And then I've always been interested in missing and murdered Indigenous women, the movement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I'm pretty interested in how COVID is impacting different communities, but I'm also really interested in how issues that some of us were engaged in prior to COVID-19 are getting ignored now, or ignored more. So I always follow all sorts of social media around being murdered Indigenous people. That has continued. I mean, every day I'm getting another notice of another missing Native person. And this very rarely gets picked up by anybody outside of Indigenous community in terms of the social media sort of outlook. Very rarely, if I post something about somebody who's missing, does it get reshared or even commented on or liked? So now it's just that much more so that these issues are being totally ignored. I mean, there were several police killings in Canada, Indigenous people, that got some attention in Canada, but pretty much zero attention here. There was even a two-spirit woman, Indigenous teenager, who was shot and killed by police, like in late March. I think the last week of March, I believe there's three killings of Indigenous people by Canadian police in Winnipeg, just in that one week. Right, as they're they're in self-isolation as well. So it's interesting that people do seem to be interested in the Navajo Nation.
Yeah.
And that COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting the Navajo Nation. And some people seem willing to talk about structural racism and how this is the reason why it's disproportionately impacting Navajo Nation. But I'm seeing missing and murdered Indigenous women, that issue has already been marginalized. It feels like it's even more marginalized right now.
Yeah, it concerns me. I wonder if it's, do you feel like it's, like, why is it the issue with the Navajo? Is it just because there's such a high profile reservation with so many members, or is it because just because Navajo people have kind of a higher profile in popular culture and maybe people can, like, why is that?
I mean, I think it's all of those reasons. You know, they're the largest tribe in the country and they have the largest land base in the country. So yeah, I think it's a sort of question of numbers. Just they've got the numbers to sort of have a bigger impact. But I think probably outside of our liberal social circle, there's probably not much attention. It's probably just that in our cultivated and curated world, like you said, we've created a bubble.
Yeah.
It probably feels like it's getting more attention than it is, because probably if you pan out, it's probably not in mainstream media, I would guess. So yeah, I think that that's probably why. And because it's speaking to what is currently a mainstream issue, which is COVID-19. If the conversation veered away from that and towards the missing and murdered crisis, it would just totally lose traction.
Yeah. Yeah, and I worry about these folks. You know, already to be so marginalized, you know, I worry about people that don't have access to resources, or, you know, if this is the way that a physician in my own practice, in my relatively, you know, just normal, basic, I can't imagine how more marginalized people are treated. And, I mean, obviously I knew about marginalization. I just had never really, I've had a very privileged life and I recognize that. I have access to everything I need. You know, I'm working with a doctor that I've known for 20 years, you know, so what is it like for more marginalized women and Indigenous women, these populations that are already suffering a dearth of services to begin with? You know, I can't imagine.
Right. And there's been a bungling of resources too, where the resources that were promised never came through. I haven't followed this super closely, but it's definitely come through my feed a lot about some kind of corruption went on and nepotism where someone was hired in Alaska and they were diverting it to someone they were related to or something like that. I was hearing things about tribes still not getting funds that were promised. Then you have the issue in South Dakota where the tribe has shut down the highways that go through their land. And the governor, who's just a quiet Karen, is saying, you have to open them. So yes, it's about marginalization. It's about a lack of access to resources. It's about a lack of resources. It's also about just the refusal of America to recognize tribal sovereignty.
Yeah.
That tribe has a right to those highways on their own land.
Yes.
From what I understand, they're the ones that maintain those highways. Not even the state maintains those highways and they happen to be on reservation land. Those portions, I believe, are maintained by the tribal nation. And they're trying to protect their tribe and especially elders.
Yeah.
Who are the ones who have the cultural knowledge and the language.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Very worrisome.
I was just talking with a colleague about one of our graduate students who's African American and a woman, and she was sick for 2 months. Really, really, really sick. Went to the doctor numerous times in Bloomington, no family in Bloomington. It was only when my colleague intervened for the student on her behalf and said, I think you are not treating her and I think you are not testing her because she is Black, and demanded that she get tested. She got tested and she had it. But, I mean, I don't know exactly what her symptoms were, but my friend said she was extremely sick for 2 months and was given nothing.
Yeah.
Given nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrifying.
And that's a grad student living in a college town.
Yeah.
Like a prestigious college town with a somewhat prestigious medical facility. Yeah.
I would like to imagine that in addition to it being a prestigious college town, that it's also a progressive place, but
right.
I don't
think more progressive than the rest of the state.
Yeah. You gotta get out of here, Liza. I gotta get out of here. I can't take it anymore.
Are you being serious? Are you thinking about relocating?
Oh, I'm always thinking about relocating.
Not to Arkansas, really, though.
No, there's not. No, I would like to go home to Chicago, go home to the region, probably actually live in the city, though. I grew up about a half an hour outside of there in Lake County. So, yeah, I would either like to go there or possibly Santa Fe.
Mm.
I really like Santa Fe a lot. A lot.
Does it feel like your future's on hold because of COVID-19?
Well, yeah. The reason that I've always stayed here is that my son's family is here, and he's at Ball State. I did have the opportunity when I divorced his dad about 10 years ago. I had the opportunity to go home then, and I thought that it was best for him at the time. He was so young. I thought it would be best for him to actually stay here in the area, so I did. But yeah, as soon as he's finished, depending on where he goes to graduate school, I'm out of here.
Oh, you're close.
We're close. Yeah, he'll be a senior this year. He's at Ball State, so he's very close to home. So yeah, we'll see. But I, you know, one thing that does also keep me here is that I really like my job at the Institute. So that's a plus. But I would like to go back to my office as soon as I can when it's safe.
Yeah. Well, I would love to chat with you without recording, but while we're recording, is there anything in your timeline that you want to address for the record, or just anything that, you know, as you were thinking about this, to make sure you mentioned?
No, I think I told you everything. I mean, I think that the thing about this story is that is the fact that it was a virtual death.
Mm.
You know, if I had to write this up, I would type that up.
Mm.
I would title it that, because, you know, I think that's everything for the record.
Okay. Okay, let me stop recording then.
Okay.